This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Now, I've always subject Israel, the wrong and the right. And these are impressions that I have gained in Israel from my own observations and from speaking to some of the people in Israel that I was privileged to meet. And there was one person that the appointment was already made and arranged, and unfortunately it meant that I would have to go down to Daybreak, and I was unable to keep that appointment, and it had to be cancelled, and I regret still that I wasn't able to see this particular person, and I have a word or two to say about him during the course of my remarks. Now, I've called this talk Israel, the Wrong and the Right, and that is the order in which I wish to deal with it, the wrong and the right. Now, I don't have to tell you that we are living not only in difficult times, but we are living in extraordinary times. We are living in a time where things just don't make sense as far as we Jews are concerned. And what is, to me, so remarkable and also simultaneously a source of great faith is that what we see now in Israel and what we see with Jews in the rest of the world, and when I say now, I'm speaking about the modern era, and the modern era I refer to the last 50 years. What has happened in the last 50 years, one cannot understand by any stretch of the imagination. And we've got two verses in the Torah, two verses in the Chol Tochacha of Kisovo, which just reflect the situation. The one is that if Israel as a people ceases to obey the Torah, then they have Pitzachu Hashem b'cholu amim mikzeho oritz v'kzeho oritz. Hashem will spread you out amongst all the nations from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth. And that is something which reflects, that is something that has happened today. Until the outbreak of the Second World War, Jews were almost in every conceivable part of the world. And then came the period of the refugees. And through the refugees, they went to places where Jews had never been unheard of, completely unheard of, a place like Chile, where Jews suddenly went, parts of Africa. And so this has come to pass, where Hashem has spread us out throughout all the earth, from one end of the earth to the other. And the second remark is, "Behoyiso meshuga mimara yenecho," and you will be stunned by this, what your eyes will see. It will be impossible to understand. And this is something that we find that is happening today, that it's just impossible to understand what is happening in Israel and round about. On the one hand, there is this terrible hatred of the Jews towards us, of the non-Jewish world towards us, and it goes far beyond it, and which we will see how it affects us. Now, I want to speak to you about the political side and the religious side. Now, as far as the political side is concerned, the question is, where do we stand at the moment in Eretz Israel? We have these riots taking place, and although when one is in Israel, and this is something very remarkable about Israel, everybody goes about his work, everybody goes about his business, and one doesn't realize that all these riots are taking place. One doesn't just see it, unless one goes into these areas. Nevertheless, it is taking place, and what is so wrong is that we Jews are not speaking with one voice. And so there are four voices that are speaking all the time. The one voice is, nothing is to be given away. The other voice is, give them the West Bank. We don't need it, we don't want it. The third voice is, let us live together with the Arabs. let them come into Israel itself, and we will have one nation. And in 50 years' time, there will be only Israelis. That we will be so part, and the Arabs and we will be part of one another, we will intermingle, we will intermarry, and there will be one people. Doesn't matter about the color, who cares about that? Doesn't matter about religion, we don't believe in that. We will be one people. Now that is a definite view in Israel. The fourth voice is, we have no right to Israel whatsoever. We came there, we took it away from the Arabs, we drove them out, and we have no right to Israel whatsoever. We have to give it back and we must get out. That's all there is to it. If we stay there, we must know, we stay there at the pleasure of the Arabs. Now those are the four views that are being expressed in Israel today. They are four voices. They are official voices. What does the Arab world say? The Arab world speaks with one voice. The whole of Israel is Palestine. Palestine belongs to us. The Jews took it away from us. And we want the whole of Palestine, not the West Bank. We are prepared to take the West Bank only as a beginning, but we want the whole of Palestine. That is one voice with which the Arab world speaks. And those who listened to Ted Koppel interviewing Jewish representatives and Arab representatives, and he interviewed them on one night and at the same time, those who listened will have heard that the Jews have these four views, although the one wasn't very clearly expressed, but I know about it, and the Arabs all spoke with one voice. They, Palestine belongs to them. Now, what is the reason that we Jews are not able to speak with one voice? What is the reason that we have such a weak argument when it comes to that very Tuesday night? The Jews have nothing to say. What right have we got to the land? The reason is that we have gone so far away from Torah that not a single Jew amongst the secularists is prepared to say or can say the only right we've got in Israel is because God gave Israel to the Jews. It's mentioned in the Torah that he gave it to Abraham. Again with Yitzchak, it's mentioned in it to Yitzchak that he gives it to Yitzchak and his seed. With Yaakov, it's mentioned again that he gives it to Yaakov and his seed. That is the only right we have gotten, that is all. And without that, we haven't got a case. Now, when you get people in the government of Israel, I'm excluding the religious parties, they are not prepared to say that. They have got no case whatsoever. And the Arabs are making their case very strong, and when they are confronted with the argument by the Jews, by the secular Jews, by those in political power, they're confronted by the argument, but even when you did have Palestine, you were killing the Jews. You killed them in 1929, you killed them in the early 1920s. Their argument is, of course we killed the Jews. They decided to take the land away of us at the first Zionist conference. That is when they decided. And we knew, we saw what they were doing. They were coming and they were settling. And their plan was, and their plan was made known, that they want a land for the Jews. Then came the Balfour Declaration. Of course we opposed it. You were taking our land away from us. That is their claim. Now in 1937, when riots were taking place, had been taking place since the 1920s and into the 1930s, and Jews were being killed by the Arabs, and England had the mandatory power over Palestine as it was then, there was the Peel Commission, and this subject came up before the Peel Commission. The Peel Commission, which was a royal commission which took place in London, and this problem came up with the Peel Commission. With what right have the Jews, what right have the Jews to demand Israel? Now, you'll remember that there was the Balfour Declaration, which was given, I think it was in 1918 or 1919, 1918 probably, or 1917, there was the Balfour Declaration, and the Balfour Declaration read, the main sentence in it was, His Majesty's Government views with favour the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine, provided it doesn't infringe on the religious rights and the civic rights of others. But what it said was that His Majesty's Government views with favour the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine. So they were bound to that. But they wanted to know, what right have the Jews got it? The Jews spoke with one voice, and they said, it's the Bible. And England respected it. Ben Gurion took out of his pocket an old worn Tanakh, and he opened it and he read, and he feigned surprise that they couldn't understand, that they should even ask a question, what right of the Jews to Palestine? It says so in the Bible. And the Peel Commission, which was a Goyish commission, the Peel Commission accepted it. That was our only claim. We spoke with one voice. Today, Israel speaks with four voices, and the Arab world speaks with one voice. Now that is, as far as I see, that is the political problem as it is in Israel. Now, what is the position? What should be our view? I'm concerned only with the Torah view. Now, even in the Torah world, things have gone wrong and things have gone right. And I shall speak about the things that have gone wrong and the things that are right in the Torah world. And one of the things that have gone wrong in the Torah world is that there are also two voices. There is an authentic Torah voice and there is a non-authentic Torah voice. And I think I should take the opportunity as briefly as I can to give you something of the history of why there are these two voices in Israel. Now, the Rambam, wrote several works. Amongst his least known works are several letters which he wrote. One of those letters is Egeres Table, the letters that he wrote to the Yemenites. The Yemenites were being forced to accept Mohammedanism, and he wrote a letter to them at the request of one of their great men. He wrote a letter to them, one of their great Talmidei Chachamim, he wrote a letter to them of Chizuk and Yidut, giving them strength and giving them encouragement that they should keep to the Torah and study the Torah. And in the course of that letter, he says that from the moment the Torah was given, everything was done by the non-Jewish world to destroy the Jewish people. And it was done in one of three ways. One way in which it was done was by force, forcing the Jewish people to give up their religion. Another way in which it was done was by words, speaking to them, being kind to them, making everything open to them. If you come over to us, you are part of us, you can be part of us. And the third way in which it was done was by saying, all this is very well, you've got a religion, but we need something in addition to that. And so there is an additional religion, and of course he is referring to the Christian religion, to the Mohammedan religion, which says, the Bible, of course the Bible is true, and we accept the Bible, that's the Old Testament, and the New Testament too. Those were the three methods that were used. Now, the Rambam wrote this letter at great peril to his own life, and he asks that this letter shouldn't fall into the hands of the Gentiles in Yemen, nor of his own country, and he was at that time living in Egypt. This letter did a tremendous amount for Yemenite Jewry. The Chofetz Chaim said in his day, said the Chofetz Chaim, and he still belongs more or less to our period. The Chofetz Chaim said that those three methods have now been adopted by Jews themselves to break the Torah and to take the Torah away from the Jewish people. He says the method of force. Now, I don't know whether this is known to you at all, but when communism came into Russia, there were 3 million Jews in Russia. There were Jewish communists, and the Jewish communists were the worst enemies of Torah and of the Jewish people. It was the Jewish communists that saw to it that there was to be no Torah, that there was to be no observance. It was the Jewish communists that knew about the mikveh and closed down the mikvehs. We know that at Moshe Feinstein, there's a difference in his family. There's a space of 13 years when there were no children. 13 years when he lived in Russia, and not only were the mikvehs closed, but at the river, they put guards at the river, and any woman who went to the river would be shot. That was done by Jews in Russia, says the Chofetz Chaim, that these three methods about which the Rambam speaks, which the outside world has adopted to break the Torah, these three methods are now brought about by Jews. The second method, you've got the secularists. They take the Bible and they make an absolute mess of it. It wasn't written by Moses. It was written by Hammurabi. Many people wrote it. There's no such thing as Torah min HaShemayim. And if there's no such thing as Torah min HaShemayim, you break down everything. I mean, can you imagine that any sensible person, can you imagine, who doesn't believe in Torah min HaShemayim, can't put on the lights of Shabbos. Can't put on the lights of Shabbos. Travels in a plane. My kosher food, please. Kosher food? Did you order kosher food? Yes, we ordered it. We ordered it twice. And the third time we reminded to them, they were quite annoyed. And they said, of course you've ordered kosher food. No, no kosher food. It's a long journey. 16 hours. And I go up the plane and down the plane. There's not a single person that knows me. And I'm really hungry. You think if I didn't believe in Torah and Shemaim, I wouldn't have a jolly good meal. And why shouldn't I? A man thinks out a cock and bull story about what animal you can eat, what animal you can't eat, customs and all that, and I've got to sit and hunger because of that? It happened 3,000 years ago. Of course I wouldn't pay any attention to it. No Torah min HaShemayim, you break down everything. Says the Chofetz Chaim, in our own people are doing it. And the new religion, what is the new religion, says the Chofetz Chaim? The new religion is, you don't need Torah at all. If you do need Torah, you need something in addition to it. You need nationalism. Nationalism is something that will save the Jewish people. But what's about the Torah? Well, there's such a thing as religious nationalism too. You can have nationalism and you can have Torah. So the Chofetz Chaim says that we have got now within the Jewish people themselves, we've got these three means that are being used in order to break down the Torah. Now, the Chofetz Chaim goes on to explain, and he says, and you know, I heard all this, and I read all this by the Chofetz Chaim when he was appealing to the Torah world. I saw all this, and I read all this, and I heard all this, and I heard it repeated, and I heard my teachers speaking about it. But that was when it was all so distant. One didn't realize what it was that was going to come as a result of all this. And now it's all come about. And the Chofetz Chaim said, you know, if you take the Jewish people, in his day there had already been 2,000 years without a land. 2,000 years without a land, and we were still a people. What is it that kept the Jewish people all this time? 2,000 years, no land. The only thing that kept the Jewish people was the Torah. They studied the Torah, they believed in the Torah, that was the only thing that kept them. Now this is something that has never been experienced before, never experienced since, that a people could be without a land for 2,000 years and not only survive, but be dynamic and be creative. What a literature they created. What a total literature. It's already on the time of the Tannoim. We didn't have a land of our own. We had the period of the Tannoim, the period of the Amoraim, the period of the Goyim, the period of the Rishonim, the period of the Achronim. 2,000 years. And what a period it was. Vibrant. Without a land. Torah, without Torah we couldn't have managed. Without a land we didn't manage. Says the Chofetz Chaim, you know, a person needs, in order to live, he needs air and he needs bread. Now which is more important? He says if he hasn't got air, no point in providing bread. So the first thing he's got to have is air. And that is the Torah. However important Eretz Yisrael is, he said, the Torah is there. Without Torah, you can't have anything at all. Now, the Chofetz Chaim and the Gedolei Yisrael of that day and the Gedolei Yisrael of today have as their basis for everything the supremacy of the Torah. The Torah comes before anything else. Nationalism, the land comes before everything else. Religious nationalism, everything is subsidiary to the land. Everything is subsidiary to Eretz Yisrael. Everything is subsidiary to the ancillary to the state of Israel. That is really the deciding factor. Now the Chofetz Chaim, and I'm speaking about his day already. Don't forget, he died in 1933. In his day, he made the following remark. He said, you know, if a descendant of Haman or Rosha becomes a Jew, once he becomes a Jew, he's an Amalekite, but once he becomes a Jew, not only is he accepted, but there are laws regarding him. You must love him. But it says, in any case, in the Torah, over and above loving him as your next one, you've got to love him because he is a Gael. He's become a Jew. How we love him. On the other hand, says the Chofetz Chaim, what happens? There is a Jew who doesn't believe in the Torah. Doesn't believe in Torah Mirashua. There's a Jew who doesn't believe and doesn't keep anything in the Torah. He's a nationalist Jew. He says there is a din as far as the Torah is concerned. He's got no place at all. No law that we love him. No law that he's part of us. Nothing at all. Take in Eretz Yisrael. Of course Eretz Yisrael is most important. There are two whole Sidurim, two whole orders in the Talmud, which contains only six orders, which concern only Eretz Yisrael. Kochim and Taros, those two orders concern only Eretz Yisrael. In addition to that, you take all in every other order, there are Masechtas that concern only Eretz Yisrael. Sanhedrin, the last part of Sanhedrin, the whole of Sodom, the whole of Nozim. All concerns only Eretz Yisrael. A Jew cannot fulfill himself in its entirety without Eretz Yisrael. Of course we want Eretz Yisrael. And he was at that time speaking about the kibbutzim. And in his day, there were the kibbutzim that were going to Eretz Yisrael, and it was completely, completely anti-religious. No belief in God, making it quite clear. In the 1920s, when they built the big synagogue in Allenby Street in Jerusalem, there was on Pesach a demonstration by kibbutzniks who didn't believe, and they rode on the first day of Pesach on horses down Allenby Street, eating, munching bread, sandwiches, meat and milk and tafer meat, munching down, doing everything possibly wrong as demonstration. Of course he says that is, and then is that what we've got to support? He said, we don't support that. Now that was already the Chofetz Chaim. Now I'm trying to explain something to you. I make every allowance. I make every allowance for people who have never been exposed to Torah and have no hatred to Torah, but they just don't believe. They don't understand it and don't believe it. I make every allowance for that sort of thing. But one thing we've got to understand. There is a certain weakness that a person has. When he feels he is wrong, he gives way to the other side and he speaks from a position of weakness. That's what you've got the position of the secularists in Israel today. They've got no case for Israel. They've got nothing to say why Israel should belong to us. Maybe all sorts of excuses. You've got to understand the Arabs. Don't say you've got to understand the Jews. They say you've got to understand the need of the Arabs. They don't say you've got to understand the need of the Jews. This is a weakness. And Jews have a weakness with this also. Oh, it doesn't matter. He gives charity. He's a very good man and everything. And we don't realize what it is all about. Of course we've got to understand a person that has never been exposed to it, but we've got to understand where we stand, and we've got to realize what is the Torah view towards it all. Now, that is what the Chofetz Chaim spoke about. What is the religious view in Israel today? Israel, you've got the religion, the religious people are also divided into two parts. You've got those who are religious Zionists, religious nationalists, and on the other hand, you've got those who are religious and want to be guided only by the Torah. Now, in both camps, amongst the religious nationalists, you will find those who say, under no circumstances must we give back any land. And there are those who say, look here, let us give back the West Bank at least. Now, what is the position with the religious Jews who are not religious nationalists, but who believe in the supremacy of the Torah? And I wanted very much to meet with Rav Shach, and that was the appointment that was arranged for me to go down to Bnei Brak to meet him, and I just couldn't manage it, it just couldn't be arranged, and I was unable to go down, and I wanted to discuss this with Rav Shach. I heard his views, but I wanted to hear it from him and to be able to discuss it from him. Now, you find amongst the religious Zionists, you find those who say, you are not allowed to give back any part of Israel that we've already conquered to give it to the Goy. And what is the worst part of all is that they cite their authorities. But when these people cite their authorities, the best thing to do is to ask them to show it to you in writing. And when you see it in writing, it's altogether a different story. But it is true that they have got rabbis, and these rabbis are appointed by them, and these rabbis have said you must not give back any part of Eretz Yisrael. But these rabbis are those rabbis who are appointed by these people, and who are fed by these people, and whose salaries are paid by these people, and it's the easiest thing for them to depose them, to take their positions away from them. And once a person is not independent, he is not in a position to give decisions, not in a position to give Torah decisions. And that is why the chief rabbi of Israel has never been the authority on Torah. He's a paid official. And we've had some outstanding chief rabbis. When Rabbi Herzog was chief rabbi, he was very careful. When he was asked to give a decision, he used to call the Rosh Yeshivas together, he used to call the Agudim, the leaders of the various Hasidic movements together, discuss everything with them. And when he gave a decision, it was the decision that was taken together with all these great luminaries, with all these great authorities. And he never went wrong. With Rabbi Unterman did the same thing. And he had a much more difficult task than Rabbi Herzog. And it came the time when Rabbi Unterman, he called the leaders together, what is the Torah view? And together they sat down and decided the Torah view, and that was his decision that he gave. Then it came to a question of who is a Jew, and these questions, and he said, now, what is our stand? And they sat together and came to a conclusion, and it didn't take them too long to come to a conclusion. It was so simple. It was so direct. And he said to them, you know what this means. If I give this decision, it means that I lose my position. They were very concerned about that, because they knew that the next rabbi would never consider doing what Unterman did. They said, this time we've got to make a stand. Can't be helped. There's nothing we can do. He said, very well, he gave the decision, and immediately a meeting was held, and he lost his position. He's no longer chief. He was no longer chief rabbi, and another chief rabbi was appointed. So we don't take our decisions from those people. Now, I've been told of very good authority, and I can understand the decision very well, that Rav Shach said there is no reason for not giving land back to the Arabs if it means Jewish life is going to be saved. If Jewish life is not going to be saved, we've got no right to give it back. Now, I want you to try and realize what that West Bank means. In Israel, altogether, there are a little more than 3 million. There are 800,000 Arabs in Israel itself. On the West Bank, there are at least 1.25 million Arabs on the West Bank. There are over 3 million Palestinians outside of Israel waiting to come back, who want to join up with the 1.25 million Arabs on the West Bank. 1.25 million Arabs on the West Bank. 800,000 Arabs in Israel itself. Over 2 million Arabs. And we are barely 3 million. What chance have we got there? And they hate us. And it means that we have really got what we have got is a Trojan horse. If we give them back that land, we're not interested in them. They want to come into our territory, we shoot them. Every right to do so. We're not responsible for you, this is our country, you want to come here, we defend. It would be a very good solution. We don't get anything out of this West Bank. The only thing is we've got 60,000 Jews living there now. Those are the settlements. We can't throw 60,000 Jews to the mercy of the Arabs. We know exactly what is going to happen. That is something that we can't do. That is our dilemma. But about giving the land back, there's nothing in the Torah that says that at this stage, if it's a question of saving life, nothing in the Torah that says you can't give that land back. We are not living at a time where we can say, well, Mashiach has come and this is our land. We are coming very close to it, but that time hasn't arrived. So amongst the Torah Jews, they are led by the spokesman of Torah Jewry today, and that is Rav Shach. And this is what Rav Shach had said. One can't just give the land back to them because of 60,000 Jews, which I don't know what to do with these people. And Rav Shach was the one who was opposed to the settlements in these areas. He felt that the danger was too great. We didn't know what was going to happen there. Now that is the situation that you have as far as the political side of things in Israel are concerned. And now I would like to turn to the religious side of what is going on there. On the religious side, again, you've got the wrong and the right. You know, there is a passage in Amos that runs like this. Hine yomim boi le'um Hashem edim. Behold, there will come days, says Hashem, ve'yishlachti ro'o bo'oretz, and I will send a famine in the land. Lo rov lalechem lo tzomo la'amayim, not a famine for bread, nor a thirst for water. Ki im lishmoa es divrei Hashem, but to listen to the words of Hashem. V'lo miyom miyom, and they shall wander from sea to sea, u'mitzofel piad mizroch, and from north to south, yeshiltetu lebakesh es dvar Hashem, they shall run to and fro to seek the word of Hashem, v'lo himtzol, and they shall not. Now the point of Izharov, who made a tremendous contribution to Torah in Israel, a tremendous contribution, there is a great Torah in Israel today, and it was the seed that was planted by the point of Izharov. The point of Izharov asks, what is so terrible if there is a thirst for Torah? This is something that is good, and that people should run all over in order to find the word of Hashem. This is something that is good. Why is it written in a way where Amos predicts that this is one of the curses that will come upon the world? The Yovim HaBoy. Now, when the Tanakh speaks about Ba'akris HaYovim in the end of days, and when the Tanakh speaks about Yovim HaBoy, the days that are to come, it is speaking about what the Chazal afterwards calls Iklis to the Mashiach or Chavle Mashiach. And that is when one already hears the footsteps of Mashiach or the birth pangs of the coming of Mashiach. And the way the Chazal take it is the way it's taken in Gemara, that the whole period of exile is regarded as a woman that is with child, and she is waiting for the child to be born, and the nearer the time comes for the child to be born, the more difficult it is, until at the very last moment there are the chevle leido, there are the pangs of birth, and then the child is born. And the Chazal say that it is the same with the Jewish people. Before the deliverance, before the redemption, that is the worst time. And so we find that in the case of the Bnei Yisrael, when they were in Egypt, things went from bad to worse and from worse to worse until it became so bad that the Egyptians refused to give the Jews, the Bnei Yisrael, the wherewithal to produce the bricks that they had to supply, and yet they've got to produce the same number of bricks. That was that it became so bad, and then it was the time that the deliverance came. And so the Chofetz Chaim said, the Ponovich Rav said, the same applies today. And what is going to happen is that in the end of days, people will search and will want to, they will go and want to find Torah. There will be a thirst for Torah. There will be hunger. There will be a drought for Torah. And they will run all over and they won't find. How is it possible that they won't find? Now, we are living in an affluent society. We don't really know what true hunger is. But the Potter-Vigeron did know what true hunger was. He knew true hunger from the end of the First World War, when there was terrible famine in Russia and in Poland and Lithuania and these countries. And he says, in a famine, what happens? The person who is living in a time of famine looks for food. He goes and he grovels in the rubbish, in the garbage. And if he finds potato peels, he eats the potato peels. He would never look at it at any other time. But it's a time of famine and drought. If he finds water and the water is muddy, he'll still drink the water. The water isn't clean. He will still drink the water. He's got nothing else. And Ponovicherov says, this is what Amos predicts. That there will come a time when anything will pass as Torah. And that is what is wrong in the Torah world. We've got a tremendous amount of things that are going on that just pass as Torah and is not Torah. You find that there are people who are giving shiurim, and some of these shiurim were repeated to me at a social evening that was held in my wife's and my honor in Jerusalem our last Saturday night, which was absolute nonsense that these people are giving shiurim. One Rosh Hashiva told me, today, he said, I can't introduce Musav into my yeshiva. You are dealing with Israeli young men. They don't want to be told what to do. They are not prepared to accept that one changes oneself. One endeavors to improve oneself. This is who I am and what I am. Accept me for who I am and what I am. That is the climate. Not everywhere. But those are things that are taking place. And people are flocking just to listen to all this. There is one man that hasn't come to California yet, but I'm sure as soon as he hears what wonderful things there are in California, he's going to come here. And this man knows absolutely nothing and has now become a Baal Mekubal. He's a mystic, and people flock to him and he tells them what is going to happen to them. There was one woman who can't have children, and he said a public statement, within a year you are going to have a son. What? You don't know? He said, well, it's already 6 months. He said, well, she's still got another 3 months to go. Perhaps it will be. This is being accepted. When I was at the wall, and he came up to me, and I was introduced to him, I just couldn't look at him. I just walked on. Afterwards, we left the wall, we stood outside, waiting for our taxi. And the person who took us to the wall said, now look here, can you see this car coming out? That is him. He goes right up to the wall. You can't go there. You've got to get out of the taxi here. He's a very wealthy man today. A few years ago, he was a very poor man. Flock to him, give him big sums of money. Of course he'll be found out one day. But these are the things that go on, and that is what it's from. And on the other hand, you've got such learning going on in Israel. Such depth of learning. Such breadth of learning. There are different types of learning in the different yeshivas. And it's going on all the time. There is such devotion and there's such dedication to learning. We've never seen the like of this in post-World War II Jewry. That is all taking place in Israel today. The Gemara tells us that one of the Amoroim, speaking about the Iknesset Mashiach, this period before Mashiach comes, described it, and he said, may those who will see it will be the unhappy ones. One will have to go through so much. Didn't I want to even see that there will be so much that will be wrong? But there is so much that is right. Now, that person, when this was being discussed in the time of the Gemara, they said, so what must the person do who is living in the time of Mashiach? He must do two things, study the Torah and to be his chesed, and do chesed. The Meir Soloveitchik, who was very critical of the position of Torah Jewry 3 years ago, I had a very long session with him, and he said to me, do you realize what has been happening in Israel now? You can get a minyan, the minyonim for Shachri start at 4 o'clock in the morning, they've got summertime. Starts at 4 o'clock in the morning, very, very early. You've already got a minyan going for Shachri. It goes until almost midday, then starts mincha. It goes until evening, and then starts maariv right until midnight. All over this is going on all the time. The learning that is going on all over, the yeshivas, the private learning that is going on, all the time. Then said the Meir Soloveitchik to me, and the Gemilas Chesed. And I knew why he was saying it, and he knew what I was thinking of. In the time of Iknes and the Mashiach, study the Torah, and engage in Gemilas Chesed. He said to me, do you know that every day in Jerusalem, hundreds of thousands of dollars are passing from hand to hand, people lending each other and helping each other. No interest. Hundreds of thousands of dollars, people just helping each other out. So this is the Gemilas Chesed that is going on. Life is very difficult. And yet we found a great improvement from what it was 3 years ago. There was the quality of the people had improved in spite of all these difficulties. Now, this is what we think. If you were to ask the question, what was the highlight in my visit to Israel? I'm going to tell you of a person, again, whom I should have met, but there was not the time. And a certain gentleman, no longer so young, he wanted me very much to meet this person. Just quickly. His name is Reb Yitzchok Balch. You want to know what learning is going on. Rev Yitzchok Balach is a businessman. I wanted to know what his business was. He's an antique dealer. I said, where is his factory? So I know already how things are done there. And they said, no, not like that at all. I said, where is his business? He says, his business is at his home. I said, what do you mean at his home? He says, he's got a telephone. And he deals in antiques. I said, where does he keep his antiques? He says, he doesn't keep them. Now go and understand the business like that. But let us see, what is this man? Very wealthy man, that's what he does. So he spends very little time on his business. In Beis Meir, that is outside Jerusalem, but not very far outside Jerusalem, I suppose it is a half an hour run by bus outside of Jerusalem, perhaps less, he has a kollel, and in this kollel he keeps 20 men, only to learn. But they are top people. And all this was explained to me by one of the men who is in his kollel, and whom he appointed to lead the kollel. He chooses each one of these men, he said, much more carefully than a man chooses a husband for his daughter. Much more carefully. They leave home on Sunday morning, and they come back on Thursday night. Leave their families on Sunday morning and come back on Thursday night. The Yitzchok Balach does exactly the same. Leaves his home on Sunday morning, returns on Thursday night. Now, this is only one place that I'm aware of. He doesn't want anybody to know about it. When the rabbi of Beis Meir made a statement about this particular institution in his community, very proud of it, and it was reported in the press, that Yitzchok Balach was most concerned about that, and actually had a din terror with the rabbi, with what right did he have to speak about it at all. But I must tell you a little bit more about it, Yitzchok Balach. He has 21 children. 21 children. And this is his code. He is appointed Rabbi Avir Ornstein as the head of the kollel. He doesn't want to be there. He supports the kollel. He doesn't collect any money. He supports these 20 people. Doesn't want anybody else to support that. And I was told about this man. Just listen to this. I was told about him the Shabbos before we were leaving. I just couldn't get the chance to see him. Sunday morning, he leaves for Beis Meir. Now you might ask, with what right has he got to do that? Surely he's got an obligation to his wife. Can't do that. There are laws of the obligation that he has to his wife. How can he do a thing like that? But it's not only he, it's 19 others. They are 20 altogether. I want to explain that to you. That is for us ordinary people, that law applies. Rabbi Akiva was away from his home for 24 years, two periods of 12 years. He was away for 12 years. How can he be away for 12 years? He's got an obligation to his wife. He came back after 12 years, and as he was going into his home, he overheard a conversation between his wife and a friend. And the friend said to the wife, how can you permit it that your husband is away for 12 years? And her answer was, because of what he is achieving. So many thousands of disciples. And, said she, if he were to ask me for permission, I would say, go and spend another 12 years. And Rabbi Akiva, without going inside, went back for another 12 years. No man has got the right to do that to his wife. The most he's got the right to do is 10 days a month. That is the most. That is ordinary people, ordinary great people, but they are extraordinary great people, believe it or not, and they fall under a different category altogether. You get women who are prepared to do that for their husbands, that their husbands should sit and learn, not only because of the love that they have for their husbands, but that is their avasa Torah. And the avasa Torah knows no bounds. They fall under another category altogether. My wife, who wanted to see Rebbe Yitzchok Balak's wife at least as much as I wanted to see Rebbe Yitzchok Balak, and I overheard the wife of the person who heads the Kollel, who is a Talmid of mine from South Africa. But he is just one of these minds. He's a genius. He's just a genius. And he is heading that Kollel. But he says, he's heading, what does it mean heading the Kollel? All he does is, Rabbi Yitzchok Balak gives him the check at the end of the week, and he gives the checks out to each star, each one of the 20 men. He said, that's all really what it means, being the head of the institution. They say that his wife is a most presentable woman. 21 children. And my wife quickly made a cheshbon and said, but you can't have 21 children that have. Some of them are married. They said, yes, there are 18 children that have, 3 already out. Now to run a home like that, this was my greatest thrill in Eretz Israel. There's a secret to that. And please forgive me for telling you this story. It's distasteful to me to tell it to you because it concerns me to such an extent. There is a man who recently joined my community. A businessman. A very, very wealthy businessman. He comes to me once a week, and he said to me, what was the highlight of your visit to Israel? And I told him the story of Rebbe Yitzchok Balak. I said, that was my highlight. And I left it at that. And he said to me, and my highlight is that I've got a rabbi whose highlight was Rebbe Yitzchok Balak. I felt that he could have paid me no greater compliment than that. And I was satisfied that I had the right kind of person in my community. That gives you some idea of the things that are taking place in Eretz Israel. The right that there is there. Rabbi Yitzchok Balak has got 21 children. 17, 16, 15, many. 8 children, just about the average. There is a very young community at a place called Beth El. It's very near to the Shidochim, it's very near to the Arab, to the West Bank, but not in it. There are 400 young families. They made a survey shortly before we arrived in Houston. The average there was, to date, 5 children per family. A very young one that's increasing all the time. The man who told me this, his daughter and son-in-law are the oldest in the community. They've got 9 children. Amongst the secularists, all you've got is 1 child. There are those who can't take Israel, life is difficult, and they are Yehudim and they leave Israel. I'm not prepared to judge anyone who leaves Israel because he can't make a living. Parnos is most important. The people who are leaving Israel are not the religious ones. Occasionally a religious person. The aliyah to Israel, the religious ones, occasionally a non-religious one. Can you imagine what is happening? No wonder the secularists are fighting us to this. They realize what is happening. Israel is going to become a religious country. I don't know whether it will be a theocracy. I don't know how things are going to develop. But what I do know is it's going to be religious. I remember our very first visit to Israel. I remember how I went into a bank and how impressed I was. There was one person in the bank that was wearing a little yarmulke. Today, wherever you go, you've got one stretch there. You've got no idea what a stretch it is. Mattersdorf, Itri, Unstorf, Belge, Klausenberg, Tan, Elsa Stolon, Chabad, Shabi, just one belt. You've got by the gun a whole area. You've got a new area, Har Nof, that has been built up. And I said, what is the percentage of Orthodox? He said, Chredim, those are those who believe in the supremacy of the Torah, 95%. Religious nationalists, 5%. 100% religious. A whole new suburb that's been built up of Har Nof, completely religious. I'm speaking only about Jerusalem. No wonder there is such hatred on the part of the secularists towards the religious Jews. They see the writing on the wall and understand what it is all about. And now, just as far as the future is concerned, the Gemara says that either Kulam will come or Shiach will come, either Kulam Zakai or Kulam Chai. Either everybody will be righteous or everybody will be not righteous. And there are two interpretations that are given to it. The one is given by my uncle. My uncle, the Chronic Lord, said, we look upon the whole period of the Galut as payment for the wrong that we have done to get ourselves right. That is the whole purpose of the Galut, the whole purpose of our exile. Now, he said, when a person is ill, and he needs an operation. Nothing will help but an operation. So, the doctor sees to it that this man has got an operation. He says, but even if an operation also won't help, so are they going to operate on him? They won't operate. So my uncle said, if everybody has done tshuva, everybody belongs to the Torah world, of course Mashiach will come. He said, Kublai Khan is me. Can't do anything. There's no hope anymore. Can't do an operation. An operation is not going to help in those circumstances. The Gula will come. But come it must, even if we are all there. The Chofetz Chaim had a different interpretation, and both things are correct. He said, the world will be, it doesn't mean either all good or all bad. It says it will be either completely good. In Hebrew, you can give this interpretation to it. It's not an interpretation, it's a translation. Either the world, the Jewish world, the Torah will be completely good or completely bad. And that is something that is happening today. Either you are coming over completely with all the belief in Hashem, in Torah min Hashemayim, or you don't believe in anything at all. These are the two extremes. There are those who are moving towards the extremes of not believing in the Torah. There are those who are coming back to the Torah. It says in this week's Sefer, and the land will give forth its produce, and the tree will give its fruit. Now, if it says that the land will give its produce, why does it have to say the tree will give forth its fruit? That is included. Rashi says it's speaking about Ilonei Srak. When Moshiach comes, non-fruit-bearing trees, they belong to that category, they will also bear fruit. I always found it so very difficult to understand until I took careful note and reflected on what is happening in our world today. When one just thinks about it, I'm dealing with people, and I met them in Israel, a Talmid of my son. We are sitting and having dinner with his wife, with his mother, the mother of this town, the Talmid, a lovely young man, believes in the Torah, works on himself, learns Musa, works on Musa. The mother is there, doesn't keep anything, doesn't believe. And the mother turns to me and said, have you ever heard of this particular man? I said, I've heard something. Tell me more about him. He was a Jewish writer in the 20s in New York. I said, a Jewish writer in the 20s? That means he was a Yiddishist. She says, yes, she was very pleased that I understood it. I said, that means he didn't believe in anything. She said, yes, he didn't believe in anything. How have you got a grandson like this? He said, he doesn't know about it, he's dead. And I said to her, and if he knew about it, wouldn't he turn in his grave? She said, no, he doesn't believe in the life after death, never believed in it. Wouldn't. Just didn't mean anything to him. Doesn't mean anything to her. But this young man, shall you go? It's a non-fruit-bearing tree. But the grandfather and the great-grandfather were non-fruit-bearing trees. And here, you've got a young man. But that is only one. And I'm not speaking of people who try everything, run about trying everything. I'm speaking of people who would make and be a success in any walk of life and are devoting themselves to death. What hope there is to be in Israel today and to be amongst those Torah people with all their hardships, the Torah learning, the Gemilus of Chesed that is going on. What satisfaction it gives us. What hope it gives us. And above all, what faith. We've got just a few more minutes. Is there any questions, anyone in the background?
At the beginning of the State of Israel in 1948, there were a number of people who were religious, were they fit that category, your category, but they opposed the founding of the State of Israel on the basis that only Moshiach, or even today there are still people, only Moshiach will establish the State of Israel. And any establishment of a State of Israel is against the Torah.
It's not quite like that. That is the way it is presented by the non-religious Jews. What actually was the case is that there were Jews who said that they cannot accept a government consisting of people who don't believe in the Torah. And call it a Jewish state, that we can't accept. And today they said, this isn't Eretz Israel. This is Medina's Israel. It's the state of Israel. It's not the land of Israel. That is what they said. That we can't accept. When Mashiach comes, we have a religious state. But we can't accept it that this is. And you find that the religious Jews are not prepared to say that this is the beginning of the coming of Messiah. So we're not at that stage yet. If this is the Mashiach, yes. The birth pangs of the coming of the Messiah, yes. But the birth hasn't taken place. That is what it is. Yes.
Are any of the religious parties today in Israel fall into the category that you would refer to as, you know, the centrality of the Torah?
Yes.
Any of the religious parties that are participating in the government?
Oh, very much so. There is the Agudas Yisroel. Very much so. There's no question about the supremacy of the Torah. And I had a long interview with Rabbi Polish, who's the leader of that particular group. I was fortunate enough to have this long talk with him. And some of the things I've told you has been the result of my discussion with him. Oh, very much so. Yes?
From a purely political point of view,
yes.
Is there any possibility, any likelihood, do you see, that this large body of Arabs could indeed throw out that small population of Jews?
In Israel itself?
Israel itself.
Now, I'm going to tell you something only because you asked me the question. But we've got tremendous faith. And it's a faith that isn't blind, but it's a faith built in observation. I wish I could speak to you with greater length on this subject. There is a passage in the Gemara in Sanhedrin which says, it says that Israel will have a government which will consist of kofri, non-believers. It says that we will lose Israel for a short period. I think it is about 9 months. We will lose Israel and then we'll get it back again. All sorts of things can happen. But that we know that we will get it back again. But when one is in Israel, one sees no sign of anything like that. Amongst the many things that the Mayor Soloveitchik said to me was, just look. He said, when you examine the position, the danger that there is. All these people go about the world, they don't speak about it, nothing. As if God has made them immune to what is taking place around about them. And that is exactly what the position is. Carry about their work. And you know, you walk in this, amongst these religious people, and you immediately, their business is Torah Gemilas Chesed. And they've got spare time, any spare time, that is spent on making living. But that is the way they do it. And you know our bracha that we make, Ashik Rishon, when it's the Soviet Tivonu, La Asok the Divrei Sarah. We ask you, Asok, the word is the same word that is in business. And the Chofetz Chaim said that in a time like this, what we must do is in the same way, all the energy that a person puts into his business, and I'm glad I'm speaking to a business man, all the energy that he puts into his business and all the thoughts and everything, the planning, that put it into the Torah also. Do the same with the Torah. If one can, that is what the meaning is. La asir puti the Torah. Tremendous, and this is what one sees. Not a thought, not a word. We're living in a dangerous time. Nothing like that, as if they were immune to it. And that is a remark that it may have sort of mentioned made to me. As if God has made us immune to all this. Yes, recording.
Can you make a comment on how close or far from the Torah view Mayor Kahane stands?
You know, they don't speak about him in the Torah Society. They don't speak about him, and I can understand why. You've got a person like Elie Wiesel. Now, I don't consider Elie Wiesel a Ben Torah by any stretch of the imagination. But Elie Wiesel has got a mentor. His mentor is Rebbe Moshe Klein. Moshe Klein is a very great Lamedist. And that is his mentor. And Rabbi Kahane, as far as we know, has got no mentor. He's working on his own. He hasn't come to see what is the real Torah view. But he's certainly gaining ground, there's no question about it, especially with all that is happening. He's certainly gaining ground. And I think that there is a feeling amongst the Jewish, amongst the Bnei Torah, that they would like to see him gain more members of Parliament. It will do them good. Of course, the great thing about Rabbi Kahane, in my opinion, is that he's the only one amongst these putting him on the side of the non-Torah people. He's the only one that doesn't speak from a position of weakness. What are they giving us? What are they doing to us? It's our land. And the secularists are dead scared to say that. They haven't got the conviction. That is the great problem. Any other questions? Yes.
You mentioned that the West Bank, although there's 450,000 Jews currently living there, and that the Arab voice was one voice speaking, and that they said it was only the beginning.
That's right.
Do you feel that if the 50,000 Jews were to get off the West Bank, and if, for instance, Rav Shach said that would be the appropriate thing to do at that time, if it was according to his advice, that would just be the beginning.
There would be no peace. Everybody knows that. There would be no peace. Well, Rav Shach said, of course there won't be any peace. It's just what is the best thing to do under these circumstances? What is the expedient thing to do? Of course there won't be peace. They'll give it, they'll dig their heels in, and they immediately go out. The question is, oh, you know, it means that they're on the doorstep. They say, in any case, they're on our doorstep. I mean, 3 minutes away, and they are in Jerusalem already with their planes. They're on our doorstep in any event. Of course, the idea of giving it back when a Rav Shach says, give it back, unless, of course, if we can find a way out of these 60,000 Jews, if we can't find any way out, we can't contemplate it, we can't throw them to the Arabs. Of course, there won't be any peace. It's only we'll be able to contain the situation there. That's all it is. But we know there won't be peace. They want the whole of Palestine. And unfortunately, you get the one voice amongst the non-religious who say, you know, they are right, and we've got to get together with them, and we've got to be one people, and we all live together. It doesn't work like that. But those are the various forces. But no thought of it is that there will be peace. Of course there won't be any peace.